Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, leading economist Robert Gordon explains why growth is about over for the U.S. economy. And then at the bottom of the hour, the political scientist and frequent guest, Adolf Reed, reviews some recent race movies. Time is short, but I did want to say a few words about Hugo Chavez. He's getting criticisms from the left and the right, sometimes hard to tell apart, but none seem to acknowledge that it's really hard to run a really transformative government. His policies took millions out of poverty, fostered rich grassroots movements, and fended off the hostility of the domestic rich and the United States, all without gulags or death squads. You try that, folks. More next week. First up, Robert Gordon. Gordon, who teaches economics at Northwestern University, is a distinguished, though orthodox, member of his profession. He's created a stir with some recent papers arguing that the U.S. is facing decades of slow economic growth, and possibly the end of economic growth as we know it. I know that might appeal to a lot of people in the audience, but Gordon is right when he says that under current social arrangements, meaning the ownership of most everything by a small elite, it will produce enormous tensions. I'm not sure I buy Gordon's end of growth argument. Capitalism has proven a very resourceful thing, but it's worth listening to, given his stature among bourgeois dismal scientists. Gordon doesn't normally do TV or radio interviews. He agreed to this one, he told me, because he grew up in Berkeley and has tender feelings for the place. He asked me to say this in the intro. Bob went to Berkeley High School in the late 1950s and was chief editor of one of the nation's first high school daily papers and helped run the Berkeley High School weekly radio program. His parents made their mark on Berkeley. His father was on the UC faculty for 40 years and chair of the econ department. His mother was a member of the Berkeley City Council from 1965 to 69 and was almost single-handedly responsible for the fact that BART runs underground in Berkeley. Okay, here's Robert Gordon. Welcome, Robert Gordon. Americans look to economic growth almost as their birthright, and you are questioning its likelihood in the future. What kind of future do you see for us?
Well, for perspective, you have to start from the history. From 1890 until just before the financial crisis, the U.S. economy racked up an annual growth of output per person, total production divided by the population, of 2.0% per year. Now, it's a fact of arithmetic that if something grows at 2%, it doubles every 35 years. And so our standard of living, we got used to doubling, a little longer. It took a little longer than one generation, but it would quadruple in about three generations, and we all realized that we're much better off than our grandparents. The question is, will the current generation of young people and those still to be born continue to enjoy that doubling every 35 years? And my answer is no, for a number of reasons. And it will help to classify them if we divide them up into invention, that inventions aren't as important as they used to be. They don't change people's lives as fundamentally as they used to. And the second set of factors slowing down future growth are the things I call the headwinds, and there are a wide variety of obstacles the U.S. economy faces, which are not actually very controversial. Most people agree that these are a problem and disagree about solutions.
Let's step back a bit. Growth is actually, in a long sweep of history, a relatively recent innovation. We went for centuries. Our ancestors did not know economic growth at all.
Yeah, if you go back, the peasants in Europe in the mid-18th century did not live any better than the Romans did 2,000 years earlier. Economic growth is a relatively recent phenomenon. It started with the first industrial revolution in Britain in the late 18th century, early 19th century, with the invention of the steam engine and railroads, and then continued to accelerate with a set of phenomenally important inventions that all were grouped together in the years 1870 to 1900. And they included electricity, the internal combustion engine. That was the time when municipalities constructed waterworks and brought running water into the home and constructed sewers to take the waste out of the home. That was the period when, in a very short number of years, the telephone was invented, the phonograph, photography, motion pictures. Much of what we take for granted now is our birthright was invented in an incredibly short period of time. It took a full century for those inventions to be exploited and all of their ramifications worked out. The last three big spin-offs of those late 19th century inventions came after World War II in the form of air conditioning, the interstate highway system, and the jet airplane. If you look at things like speed, we went from about 1% of the speed of sound with the horse back in, say, 1800, up to about 80% of the speed of sound with the Boeing 707, which was introduced more than 50 years ago. And we're not going any faster now than we were 50 years ago. If you take another dimension, we could do these things only once. We could urbanize only once. We went from a largely rural country to a largely urban country. We had a big transition in the 1960s that could only happen once, from women predominantly staying at home to most women who wanted to entering the workforce. If you think about the interior of a house, they were very cold in the winter 100 years ago, and they were very hot in the summer. But we invented central heating and then later air conditioning, and we now take for granted in most parts of the country that our homes will be roughly 70 degrees summer and winter. Those are all really big inventions, and I think the current fascination with Facebook and smartphones pales in comparison.
Yeah, we'd rather have a flush toilet than an iPhone if we had a forced choice.
The way I put it is you get two choices, and you just have to choose. You can't escape this. I'm going to give you the choices set up in a way that will make my point. You can have every electronic gadget and software invented up to 10 years ago, and that includes Google, Amazon, and Wikipedia. But you can't have anything invented since 2002, which means you can't have an iPod, a iPhone, or an iPad, or Facebook. But you get to keep running water in indoor toilets. The other choice that you could make is you could have everything invented up to yesterday, including the iPhone and the iPad and Facebook, but you have to give up running water and indoor toilets. You have to go to the outhouse and carry all the water in for your cooking and bathing. Which do you choose? Usually at that point when I give speeches on this, people just laugh because they know they've been trapped.
But, of course, those inventions in the Second Industrial Revolution took economic form in just rapid growth that became what we think of as the norm.
Think of what they made possible. The internal combustion engine allowed us to replace the horse. The horse consumed fully one quarter of American agricultural output in 1910. And so by finding a mechanical means of transportation to replace the horse, we got all that agricultural production available either to consume ourselves or to sell to foreigners.
And then, of course, the horse presented enormous sanitation problems in cities.
That's right. We also got rid of the manure on the streets. Dead horses were a problem. They had to be removed, and that was somewhat more complicated than towing a Model T Ford to the nearest garage. Electricity made possible many things. It made possible the vertical city with elevators, with people working more closely together in proximity so that they didn't spend so much time in transportation, and that in turn allowed them to become more productive. So we replaced animal power with machines, we replaced human power with machines, and yet we still found jobs for everyone, at least up until fairly recently.
You know, you were skeptical about the payoff from the technological revolution of the 90s, then you changed your mind briefly, and now you're back to being somewhat skeptical. People are very gee whiz about all the technical inventions of the last 10 or 20 years, but some skepticism warranted about their transformative power?
The way economic growth happens is we become more productive. So we find some way of making more output per hour of work. And the computer revolution has achieved a lot, but it goes back 50 years. Back in the 1960s, computers made possible the first automated bank statements and telephone bills. By the 1970s, we had memory typewriters and eliminated repetitive retyping. There was a wave of innovations in the 1980s, including the early personal computers, ATM money machines, and barcode scanning, which of course made retail checkout clerks more productive and faster. Then in the 1990s, we got the the big deal, the marriage of the computer, which was getting ever smaller and ever more powerful, with communications in the form of the Internet and the World Wide Web. And indeed, we did see a brief revival of productivity growth after 20 or 30 years of slow growth in the 70s and 80s. The Internet revolution and all of the new gadgets that came with it gave us a temporary spurt of productivity growth that lasted from about 1996 to 2004. But that has now gone away. Our growth in our output per hour has slowed remarkably in the last 8 years, and that is not just because of the financial crisis. It's something more fundamental. We're not growing as slowly as we were in the 70s and 80s. The impact on our standard of living of that slow productivity growth was postponed because our standard of living can grow faster than output per hour if the number of hours worked by the population go up. In the 70s and the 80s were the period when the women were entering the labor force. So we take the whole population, a larger percentage of that population is going off to work in market-oriented jobs, that postponed the day of reckoning. But that's where we get into the headwinds, and I wanted to just lay out several of the less controversial ones.
Well, just a moment before that, you're skeptical that we're going to see anything of the pace of innovation that we saw in the past, the Second Industrial Revolution. Now, people who commented on your paper say, you know, balderdash, you know, we've always innovated. It's just we can't see the future. It's going to happen. It's almost a matter of faith. You're not taking it on faith.
No. As a matter of fact, I do collect examples of problems with innovation. Innovation is not producing the changes in our life that are as important as they used to be. Let's take the Boeing 787. It doesn't go any faster than the jet aircraft of 50 years ago. It was intended to save fuel. Now, why do we care about saving fuel? It's because the price of oil is so high. Innovations like fracking for oil discovery and natural gas is putting off a day of reckoning of running out of oil. That doesn't count as an improvement in our standard of living, and yet that's what a lot of people are heralding is the kind of innovation going on today. We have innovation in pharmaceuticals, continuing attempts to discover new drugs to cure diseases. But the number of drugs that are being approved is going down, and their intent is for more rare types of cancer at vast expense rather than the sort of antibiotics invented in the 1940s that had widespread application. So we have a lot of innovation going on. Some of it is not very successful. It's not turning out to be as fruitful as people hoped. And the things that are being invented are just not as important.
I'm speaking with Robert Gordon, a professor of economics at Northwestern. Okay, now onto the headwinds.
Well, let's take the truism that the amount of output we have per member of the population grows at the same rate as productivity if that population is working a constant number of hours. When the women came into the labor force back in the 70s and 80s, we got more hours per member of the population. But now something rather uncontroversial is happening that is dragging down the number of hours of work, and that is the retirement of the baby boomers. So our standard of living, based on how productive we are times the number of hours that each member of the population worked, is being dragged down by that. In addition, we have had a disappointing, almost shocking, a phenomenon of dropouts of prime-age male workers. The percentage of males who are in the labor force has dropped by a full 10 percentage points in the last 20 or 30 years. And that, again, is not just the financial crisis that was going on before. So overall, we have a headwind in the form of declining hours per member of the population that's holding down the amount that we can potentially grow. The next problem is our education system. Throughout the 20th century, the United States ranked number one in terms of educational attainment, the average number of years that the members of the population had gone to school. We're down to around number 15 because we've made no advance in the last 20 years in educational attainment, but around the world, other countries from South Korea to the Netherlands to Germany have caught up and gone ahead. Part of the reason for this is our rampant cost inflation in higher education, which is where prices are going up even faster than they are in medical care. Then you get to the dilemma that we face in our secondary and elementary schools. Our high school dropout rate is almost the worst among the top 30 richest countries. We have a dropout problem in our minority population, in our inner cities, and it's now becoming a phenomenon in the lower income part of the white population as well. In international tests on math and science, we rank between number 25 and number 35. We are not producing improvements in the quality of our labor force the way we did historically over the whole 100 years between, say, 1870 and 1970. The core years in which Americans went to high school, the expansion of the U.S. free high school system was between 1910 and 1940, and that was one of the many things that was giving us that historic 2% growth rate. So that's gone away as well. Everybody knows we have a problem with a government debt, fiscal deficits, and somehow we have to find a way of increasing the growth of taxes or reducing the growth of entitlements, the so-called transfer payments. But if we do that, then higher taxes or lower transfer payments reduces the income that people get to keep out of their paycheck. So that's another headwind. The last one I want to mention, which is quantitatively the most important, is the growth of inequality. It's a fact. In fact, you can go to the website of a famous professor at the University of California at Berkeley and learn that over the 15 years before the financial crisis, the growth rate of real income of the bottom 99% was more than half a percentage point slower than the average for the whole economy. The top 1% were getting fully half of the income gains, and the bottom 99% were sharing out the other half. That takes a whole half point off the growth of our standard of living that has already been slowed down by baby boom retirement, labor force dropouts, poor education, repaying the government debt, and you can see how I wind up with this gloomy forecast. The optimists keep pointing to innovation, but the optimists can't deny the baby boom retirements. They have nothing to say about education except hope. And so I think I'm on pretty firm ground with this rather remarkable prediction that has everybody quite startled.
Now, one of your headwinds is the rising cost of energy, but what if we could have a wave of innovation in clean, renewable energy that would transform the landscape in a way similar to the way that suburbanization and the spread of the oil economy did decades ago?
What we're doing is either with exploring for natural gas, which is obviously cleaner than coal, or developing wind and solar power, is we're fighting the headwind of global warming. We're trying to offset a negative. We're not actually doing anything positive on balance. When we had that rapid economic growth early in the 20th century, we were polluting like crazy, and nobody cared. The symbol of a prosperous city was one with a factory belching out black smoke. That was one of the things that allowed us to grow, was not caring about the expensive replacement of polluting energy like coal with clean sources of energy. It's more expensive to do that. It's going to reduce the amount of income we have to buy other things as we fight global warming and pollution.
Some people might say, so what? We're very rich. So what if we don't grow anymore? We can live quite well at the current standard. What would the downside be of a 0.2% growth rate stretching out indefinitely?
Big problem. It's called the zero-sum society. If you don't grow, then it means when you want to have something better, like more school teachers or fight poverty or spend money on anything, you have to give up something else. Whereas if you're in a growing society, you can have more things without giving up something else. That's definitional. So a society that doesn't grow is going to be one that's politically fractious, full of arguments, full of fighting, even more than our current political arena.
And then finally, maybe we're just tired and it's about to be China's century.
I'm just talking about the United States. I'm not talking about any other country. If you go down the checklist, Canada has a rate of completion of college education by its young people. It's 15 percentage points ahead of the United States. These problems are less significant in a number of countries. Start out with the Nordic countries in the north of Europe, Canada, the incredible achievements in South Korea. So I'm not talking about the rest of the world. This may well be China's century. Chinese high school students in large urban Chinese centers do better on math and science tests than Americans. And Asian students in America do better than white students. There may be some connection there. So even though it seems even, you know, extremely remote to conceive that China would ever catch up to the American standard of living, they may well do it by just being smarter. And that's not going to be a pleasant future to contemplate.
Though, of course, they can't escape the climate crisis.
Well, also, since I've been talking about a lot of problems and not many solutions, I wanted to suggest a great solution to both the baby boom retirement problem and the education problem. And that, obviously, the problem with baby boom retirements is we've got more old people that have to be supported by a smaller group of young people. So we want our population to grow faster. How do you do that? Open the doors to immigration. The current immigration debate is only about what to do with the illegals that are already here. Why should we have any illegal immigrants at all? Why don't we go back to the late 19th century when there were no passports? Anybody could come to the United States that wanted to. And there's a remarkable fact about that, that when our economy was bad, they didn't come. When the economy was roaring, they came. Immigrants didn't create some massive unemployment problem in the United States. The economy was growing rapidly and was quite prosperous over the 40 or 50 years of the fastest immigration. Somewhat less controversial than opening the doors completely is to vastly increase the encouragement of high-skilled immigration. Automatically give citizenship to any foreign student who gets a master's or a PhD degree, and I would say in anything. It's fairly common to recommend giving citizenship to people who have advanced degrees in the sciences. So there are solutions, and you know, if the Chinese are growing faster than we are and smarter than we are, let's just encourage a lot of Chinese to move to the United States. It would help everyone.
That was Robert Gordon, professor of economics at Northwestern University. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of Bjork doing Gloomy Sunday to deepen the gloom. Next up is Adolf Reed. Adolf is a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and is author of a long piece in some recent movies about race, The Help, Django Unchained, and Beasts of the Southern Wild. He's not pleased by them. He says why in the interview, but the full article is extremely thoughtful and everyone should go read it at nonsite.org. Nonsite, nonsite.org. Adolf Reed. Welcome, Adolf. So you've been to the movies, and you weren't entirely pleased.
Well, no, I wasn't. Although, to be honest, honest, I didn't expect to be pleased, which is kind of the reason I went. I mean, I've just had an exchange with a friend about this stuff over email, and one of the things that strikes me about the category of the mass market film that claims as its market niche in part that it has social significance is that there's a built-in backdoor exit in the face of challenges to the social significance claims, which is the fallback to say, well, they're just entertainment. I say that because if films like Django Unchained or Beasts of the Southern Wild or The Help were genuinely promoted as just entertainment, then I would never have had a beef with them. I would never spend any money on them. But it's those other claims that sort of prompted me to go out and see what's going on, and especially Django, as my son and I talked about a lot, because the misrepresentations of history that show up in those films show up in our classrooms and become part of the ideology we have to teach against.
Now, you wouldn't, or would you, agree with Adorno that every time you go to the cinema, you emerge feeling stupider and worse?
That's been my experience for a long time, probably since the end of the 70s, I guess. I can't think of a moment that I've walked out of the cinema feeling other than that since sometime after Reds, I guess.
Could it just be that we're getting older and things used to look better than they do now?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've tried to be open to that argument. I like to quote Dizzy Dean on that, wherever he said, the older we get, the better we was. But I don't know. Like, I've gone back and watched older films. And, I mean, one comparison, right, that just kind of leaps right out at me is the Wertmüller original Swept Away and the Guy Ritchie and Madonna Swept Away. And the latter is markedly dumber and more preposterous and reactionary in a banal kind of way, right? I mean, I think that's part of the problem with these films, that they're grounded on a fundamentally reactionary kind of banality, no matter what else it is that they're claiming to do.
Now let's talk about some of these movies, which I must admit I haven't seen, but we're touching on issues that are endemic to American politics, so it's not exactly like the films themselves are primary text to be dealt with.
Right.
But The Help, that seems a bit like shooting fish in a barrel.
Yeah, totally. I didn't expect it to be other than what it was, although I've heard from a number of people, and some of whom are people whose perspectives I generally take seriously, that, well, no, it wasn't exactly what you might think it was, which, of course, was the same thing that I heard from a lot of people about Driving Miss Daisy when it came out. And so at least by the time The Help came around, I didn't really pay any attention to the disclaimers, so I wasn't at all surprised. But in contrast to Driving Miss Daisy, when I went into it skeptical but trying to keep an open mind that it might possibly be something other than what it seemed it was inevitable that it had to be, and within 15 minutes I realized that, of course, it was exactly what it had to be. But The Help was just the thing that struck me most about The Help. I mean, well, The Help was a cartoon, right? And it was a cartoon that most perniciously, I think, rewrote Jim Crow in Mississippi, of all places, in 1963, as a matter of bad attitudes or even poor manners and lack of respect for the voices of the black maids. And that just seemed so much in keeping with the subsequent redefinition, or our contemporary redefinition of inequality as being about recognition and respect, or racial injustice as being about recognition of voices and respect, and completely disconnected from political economy.
Yeah, let's talk about that some. Here we are 50 years after that fictionally portrayed time, and what you described sounds a lot like a lot of analysis of race relations that you hear today, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I think that's absolutely right, right? I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And I just finished reading, actually, I'm trying to finish writing a review of Michael Katz, my colleague in the history department. Here's a comparatively new book, Why Don't American Cities Burn? And one of the things that Katz does that I think is really nice is he tries to disentangle the extent to which persistent racial inequality in economic terms at the metropolitan level since the 1950s has can be linked to your discrimination or other direct consequences of race, and the extent to which those same inequalities, even as they are expressed as racial disparities, are attributable to sources that are only indirectly, and in some cases even only weakly indirectly, linked to what might be called racism. And, you know, I mean, as you know, one of the hobby horses that I've been riding in recent years is that it doesn't make sense to call all forms of inequality that seem to have a statistical disproportion, or that seem to be expressed in racially disproportionate ways, as racism, because that's just the opposite of what I think we need to do to try to make sense of the character of the inequality, much less the sources, and much less even ways to think about trying to challenge them. I think that's a big problem. And I guess one of the points that I made in that essay about the on my field trip to the movies was that the insistence on understanding or characterizing inequalities that show up statistically as racial disparities as racism is embedded in an insistence, ideological insistence on explaining contemporary inequalities through looking in the rearview mirror, in the historical rearview mirror, and appropriating analogies of either Jim Crow or slavery. And I guess that makes sense to the extent that there's a moral force that attaches to the analogies to Jim Crow and slavery. But of course, to the extent that there is a moral force, that also means that the analogy doesn't work, because it's because the moral force presumes a victory over slavery, obviously, in Jim Crow. So, which in turn means that the persisting inequalities must be something else. They must stem from some other source. But that, of course, opens the question: well, what's so appealing about the analogy of analogizing contemporary racial inequalities to earlier patterns of social relations? And as I said in the essay, I think one source of the appeal is that that's easy. So it appeals to a kind of lazy-mindedness, and it's emotionally satisfying, because in the sense that it appeals to another sort of frustrated or a kind of politics of exasperation, we might say, that complains that nothing has changed. But I think more deeply or more fundamentally than that, it's connected, the inclination to insist on racism as an explanation for racial inequalities, even, is that it's linked to an ideological commitment to an anti-racist politics and to a political economy of race relations and race relations administration, as well as the other forms of leftism or the expressions of leftism that have made their peace with neoliberal hegemony by defining inequality as a phenomenon that doesn't really have to do with political economy anymore.
Now, you touched on this a minute or two ago, but the Jim Crow metaphor. Of course, the phrase "the new Jim Crow" is making the rounds a lot. What's wrong with that drawing that parallel to you?
Well, I mean, a number of things. The first thing, not to be pedantically historicist about this, but the first thing is that it's not, right? I mean, the Jim Crow order was a regime that came into existence or was brought into existence after the defeat of the populist insurgency at the end of the 19th century as an expression of or as a set of mechanisms for consolidating class power in the South, and it was in particular the class power of the planter merchant class, and the set of institutions both those of petty apartheid and I guess what we call the grand apartheid of denial of citizenship rights to black Americans were rooted to that political economic moment, right? And the regime of class power that was anchored in the plantation elites. After World War II, you know, that's one of the reasons, I guess I should say one of the reasons that the system was vulnerable to attack after World War II in a way that it hadn't been previously, because black people never really liked it, and tried to stop it as much as possible. But one of the reasons it was vulnerable to attack after World War II was that it had lost a good bit of its economic foundation. So the structure of petty apartheid wasn't as essential anymore to maintain class and racial hierarchy, for that matter. So, I mean, that's a problem, right? I would argue that that's not just a problem of historicist pedantry, right? Because the tendency to disconnect the social practices analytically from the institutional arrangements in which those practices were embedded really kind of cuts the historicity of the past and the present out of the picture. And look, I mean, besides, I mean, it can't be just like Jim Crow. I mean, I remember I was at a conference a number of years ago at Harvard Law School when Derrick Bell was still on the faculty there, and Bell was on a panel at this conference on which he insisted that nothing really had changed for black Americans since 1865. And I'm looking at this. Here he was, a full professor in Harvard Law School, making the assertion that nothing had changed. Well, yeah, obviously something had changed because he was in Harvard Law School without a broom in his hand. You know, the argument by analogy simply doesn't work. And, of course, the poster version of this argument now, Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, kind of makes this point for me because she dangles the analogy throughout the first two-thirds of the book. And finally she says, well, but it doesn't really work. Because this isn't Jim Crow, so there are a lot of ways that it's different. So it just seems, at the best, I could say, that it's a nice-sounding slogan, but it's not one that helps us understand anything. And I think the stronger version of my argument would be that it does just the opposite of helping us understand anything.
We're listening to Adolf Reed, professor of political science at Penn, and author of a long movie review on nonsite.org. Now, of course, there are vast differences in racialized experience of the criminal justice system, from stop and frisk actions on the streets of New York to residents on death row in Texas. So that I think people say is Jim Crowish. What do you say?
Well, I don't know what it gains for us to call it Jim Crowish, right? I mean, I think it might be a little better just to make sense of it on its own terms, that is in relation to the drug war, to policing, urban decline, and the changing logic of metropolitan redevelopment in cities over the last two or three decades that have produced this vast new lumpen proletariat or marginal working class. I'm going to try to avoid the neologisms like precariat. That's available for casual labor and fodder for the criminal justice industry and for the therapy industry. And I think it would make sense to discuss those phenomena, or in fact the general phenomenon that would encompass all those taxa, on their own terms. I mean, without the analogy to Jim Crow, among other reasons, what's the agency? I mean, if the new Jim Crow argument seems to me to posit racism as an ontological force that imposes itself transcontextually on historical circumstances, therefore, ironically, I think it separates racism from its embeddedness in the structures of dynamics that reproduce American capitalism on a regular basis, like, for instance, the extent to which racial or presumptions of racial hierarchy are built into assessments of skill in the labor market and residential real estate value quite explicitly. That would be conversation to have, right? That could point in some policy directions, but Yeah, I don't see what ontologizing racism in the way that the analogy does. What good it does for us, except for those people who are committed to a view that racism is America's original sin, or the national disease, or the commitment that will, or the pathology that will undercut any progressive political movements, and so forth and so on. To my taste, that's just way too close to the Nation of Islam's Yaqub theory.
Funny to find myself quoting Milton Friedman at a moment like this, but he did say once in a debate with George Shultz over fiscal policy that when you start resorting to metaphors, you're admitting that your argument is weak.
yeah, well, I mean, God forbid. I should also find myself endorsing anything that Milton Friedman said, even, you know, at the level of the sun shining outside. But that sounds pretty good to me.
But now this sort of takes us back to where we were at the film review a little while ago of The Help, locating Jim Crow in attitudes and personal relations. So, you know, the agency of Jim Crow, not law, very explicit law, racialized law, but this new Jim Crow is what? Attitudes?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, this is where the metaphor sort of climbs the scale of mysticism, right? Because what you get is attempts to sort of square the circle between references to structural forces and the disembodied ideology, right? So, I mean, this is kind of where the takes on a life of its own thing, you know, becomes not a metaphor, but in effect a substantive claim, right? Or a metaphor that's treated like a substantive claim. Because you get, like, what I find often convoluted, but maybe I'm just impatient, discussions of structural racism, systemic racism, institutional racism, post-racial racism, all of which feel, as I guess I've said in print now, or once at least, feel instructively like Thomas S. Kuhn's description in the structure of science. Scientific revolutions about what happens when interpretive paradigms are in crisis, and the sort of spring leaks all over the place, and the adherents have to keep patching, and you spend more time patching up ad hoc explanations of anomalies that should be explained by the paradigm but aren't, and that's the ultimate indication that the paradigm is experiencing a crisis of interpretive authority. And I think that's kind of where we are with anti-racism at this point, because there isn't. There are only two possibilities, right? Either there's an idea that drives the movement of the structural forces and gives them a teleological direction, let's just call it God, or there's not. And I think a lot of the argument that underlies the appeal of the analogy either to Jim Crow or to slavery, for that matter, and rest on an attempt to have that question both ways, or to split the difference, and you can't, it's a difference that can't be split.
Well, we could talk about something that's been making the rounds for the last few days. I think somebody did a study or something showing on the racial wealth gap, that if you take two families of similar income, look similar on paper, one is white, one is black, the black family is going to have higher debts and lower assets than the white family. Now, this is pointed out frequently. I'm not sure what's supposed to be done about it when it's pointed out, but there's a material explanation of why that might be the case, and there's also this sort of free-floating racist explanation.
Well, yeah, and I mean, in all fairness, to the best of that literature, I think this probably originates with the Oliver Shapiro Black Wealth, White Wealth book. Although, I mean, it's interesting that Dalton Conley's Living Black, Being in the Red book ultimately challenges the simplistic or the straightforward reading of the racial wealth gap, though curiously most of the people who cite the book don't cite it as completely affirming the claim. Conley found that, well, if you make real class control, that is to say control for hereditary class position, then most of the gap goes away. So that points us back, I guess, to the material explanation.
Yeah, so I mean, there's no inheritance, and so that's a perpetuation of inequality across generations that has a very concrete explanation.
Yeah, right. I mean, absolutely. And I mean, I'm curious too. The one thing that Merlin Ch- Chao Kuan-Yin and I have been discussing, you know, when we did the first cut on this for SR, that you wonder, given how much of, although I think Oliver Shapiro and some others try to control for home equity, but given how much of the wealth accumulation for most Americans since the end of the 1970s had been bound up with real estate markets and with the accumulation of so-called home equity, even though a lot of it was funny money. And I wonder, you know, what the wealth disparities look like now after, after the crash. But, yeah, I mean, still, yeah, it is kind of straightforward. Now, by the way, I mean, this, you know, one might say from a left point of view, this is another problem, with that focus. That there are some proposals that have been made for trying to address the racial wealth gap, Michael Sheridan stuff that I guess you know, right? God, what do they call those things? Individual equity accounts where they propose that the federal government would encourage poor people to save. It's kind of a branch off from the earned income tax credit. I mean, are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I know there are various savings promotion schemes, yeah.
And
it's hard to match inherited wealth with it.
Well, yeah. And, I mean, it's pure ideology, right? Because, as you say, I mean, you can't match inherited wealth. And, you know, one easy and, you know, straightforward approach to reducing inequality across the board, which would reduce racial inequality as well, would be through taxing assets and redistributing. But, you know.
Straying for a boat. We don't talk about that sort of thing anymore.
No. Right, absolutely not.
We've sort of departed from the movie review, so let's return to that to close with. I can't remember the name of the movie, but it's the one with the 9-year-old Academy Award nominee. You had cruel things to say about that. What was your problem with it?
Well, I mean, like I said, it brought to mind the photo essays that Leni Riefenstahl did of the vanishing Nilotic tribes, or what she imagined to be the vanishing Nilotic tribes, after she got out of prison. I mean, it's exoticizing, and it's exoticizing in what I thought was an unbelievably reactionary way, especially given all of the Katrina and South Louisiana kind of evocations and hype around the film, because the bottom line is that these poor people are closer to nature than we are. They have a beautiful and simple take on life and life itself. And they're committed to their odd ways and their poverty. And they don't want to be messed with. And who are we, really, actually doesn't quite go that far to say it. But Zeitlin romanticizes, certainly, their resistance to the intrusive civilization/state apparatus that wants to impose health care and hurricane evacuation on them. And I was just astounded that as many nominal progressives as did, because there were some people who were able to see through this foolishness, but took this movie as on its own terms. I mean, in effect. But a lesson that I took from that was that's an indication of just how much the fetish of the indigenous peasant in all of its reactionary forms is, how prominent that is among people who like to think of themselves as being left or progressive now.
Well, Hollywood seemed to love itself over it.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And, another thing in particular about that one was I noticed, I didn't notice this till I was working on the essay, actually, but I noticed that there's a Get Involved link on the Beast of the Southern Wild website. So I thought, what the hell is there to get involved with this? I mean, at least I could see how, Won't Back Down and Waiting for Superman had things for you to get involved doing. Just go help out your local Gauleiter. So it turns out that the Get Involved, apropos of Beasts of the Southern Wild, was to go see the movie and arrange for other people to see the movie and see when it's showing and tell other people how much you like the movie. So it's the ultimate expression of the debasement of this kind of politics, right? Social action and boosting the sales effort have now become completely indistinguishable.
That was Adolf Reed, professor of political science at Penn and author of a piece about recent race flicks on nonsite.org, nonsite.org. During the interview, Adolf mentioned the work of Michael Sheridan and his schemes of getting poor people to save. The logic of the approach is based on studies showing that if you control for income, families with higher savings do better on most social indicators than those with lower savings, all other things being equal. What this sort of analysis misses is the fact that savings are a marker of social class apart from income, a measure of privilege and expectations that can be passed from one generation to the next. Stimulating savings is an artificial attempt to mimic that inherited advantage. The approach reminds me of a college roommate who, on hearing that healthy people had mildly acidic urine, took to drinking vinegar to increase the acidity of his own. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Waiting on the Guns by Butterglory. Till next week, bye.